our languages have been dying at a pretty fast pace for the last 100 years or so, and many of the 7,000 that survive around the world are projected to carcass by the end of this century. But there's one being born in a remote village in the Tanami Desert in northern Australia. It was discovered by Australian researcher Dr. Carmel O'Shaughnessy from the University of Michigan. A new language evolved from children's speech and spoken by Aborigines who are under 35. Now, to tell us more, Carmel will be joining us online from the village, and joining her is Stephen Bird. Stephen is Associate Professor in Computer Science at the University of Melbourne, and he uses Android mobile phones as a tool for recording rare and unusual languages that are in danger of extinction. He's recently returned from the Amazon, where he was capturing some dying languages, and he's in our South Bank studio. I welcome you both to the Little Wireless program. Carmel, many languages around the world are dying, but you have discovered a new one. Is it a mixture of different indigenous languages, or are we talking about something quite unique?
Both. This is a quite unique combination of elements of languages that already existed. So it's a combination of Walbri, the traditional language spoken in this area, along with varieties of English, Aboriginal English and Australian English, and some Creole. What's unique about it is that there is, in addition, some completely new structures that come from those languages, but they've been reanalysed so that we end up with a new grammatical structure that isn't the same as in any of the languages that it comes from.
And you also tell us that, to some extent, this evolved from children's speech.
It seems that it did, yes. I think that people were code-switching a lot. Code-switching is switching from one language to another in a single conversation or even a single sentence. And I think they did this a lot, particularly when they were speaking to very young children. And so those children heard that so consistently that they analysed it as a single system rather than as switching between systems. And then I think those very young children added in the new grammatical structures as they were growing up.
You mentioned Creole in passing, the English-based Creole developed in the late 19th century. It's pretty widely spoken amongst Aboriginal people.
Yes, especially in across the north of Australia, mainly by 30 or 40,000 people. It's a first language for many people, and it's a subsequent language for many people.
Now, Carmel, how did you come across this new language?
I came to this community in 1998 to work in the bilingual education program to support the teachers teaching Walbri, the traditional language, and English. And I heard a lot of code switching while I was here. And after a while, I realised that there was something really interesting linguistically going on, and so I decided to research it.
You wrote about it, didn't you, in Language, the pretty posh journal, and that got a lot of attention.
Right, yes. It seems to have captured people's imaginations. I think the idea of a new linguistic system is very appealing.
Now, before we go crashing around the Amazon with Stephen, tell me about the village. I presume isolation is a major factor in the development of the language.
I think that it is, yes. So this community is about 600 kilometres from Katherine, which is the nearest town, and it's about 600 kilometres also from the nearest Walbri community in the other direction. But the road down to where the other Walbri communities are is a dirt road that can't be used for 4 or 5 months of the year because during the wet season you just can't drive down there. And so people tend to drive north to Katherine a lot, and Katherine's a Creole-speaking area. So when people go into that area for shopping or health reasons or whatever, and they're talking with other Indigenous people there, they're hearing and using a lot of Aboriginal English and Creole. So I think that could be something to do with why this new system kind of took hold and why there was a lot of code switching input.
I remember having a bit of a blue with Noam Chomsky some years ago about Aboriginal syntax.
Uh-huh.
For a time, he couldn't work it out. You know, it didn't seem to fit in his overarching theory. Is that still the case?
Well, that's controversial, yeah. So Walbri was, in fact, the language that was documented by the linguist Ken Hale, who realised that its syntax was completely different from anything we'd seen in English or Indo-European languages. And so there's still a reasonable amount of disagreement about how similar that the syntax of Australian Aboriginal languages is to some other languages in the world.
And of course, Aboriginal languages are immensely numerous, aren't they?
Yes. Unfortunately, as you mentioned earlier, we are losing Aboriginal languages very frequently. So there were many at the time of contact, but now there are far fewer. But there are still many being transmitted to children, so we're still hopeful that that can continue. But they're certainly highly endangered and under great threat from English.
Now, that's a perfect moment to introduce Stephen, whose mission is to preserve dying languages by recording them on a rather odd piece of technology. Stephen, you know I don't understand matters technological, so please be simple with me.
Yes, so, Philip, I've been working in Papua New Guinea and Brazil with these inexpensive mobile phones, which people, you know, in these remote areas are already starting to buy. So the idea is that they already have a mobile networked recording device.
So it's not specially designed technology, is it?
Not at all.
Ah, right.
It's a $150 phone. And the idea is to put a little bit of software on that phone that enables people to capture information about what they're saying, so that we're not just capturing a sound file, but we are recording, well, who is speaking, what language it is, where it is, and we're getting them to translate it phrase by phrase, so that even once the language is no longer spoken, we have some hope of working out what it means and maybe studying the grammar, syntax, and so forth.
Stephen, let's go to this community in the Brazilian Amazon. As we said, 7,000 languages left on the planet. And this is at the small end, with just 150 speakers left.
Yes, so one of the villages I was in, Cajueiro, where they speak the Tembe language, it's a four-hour drive from the nearest town, and we're really in the heart of the Amazon. And, you know, as Carmel's probably already also experienced, you're alone. You're as far away from home as you could be. Everything is foreign and inexplicable. And it's just quite a challenge to deal with that isolation.
What language is taking over?
Oh, in the case of the Amazon, it's Portuguese.
Pure and simple.
Or, yes. Yeah. People are switching. They think that their economic future is better if they learn Portuguese. And unfortunately, the parents are just deciding not to speak the languages to their children. And so within a generation or two, the languages go.
Do they make that decision sadly?
No, they actually are almost unaware of it. So they will speak to you about how important their language is, and then they'll go home and speak to their children in a language of wider communication like Portuguese. It's mystifying.
Now, okay, I was wrong to suggest that we're looking at dramatically new technology. You're using a simple phone. But it does involve software, which I understand was developed in Melbourne.
Yes, one of my PhD students, Florian Hanke, his name is, from Switzerland, and I've been working together for a couple of years now to develop free software for Android phones. And a key idea about this software is that you get to listen to recordings that may have been made by other people using the same software on a different phone. It was automatically synchronized. And you can interrupt a recording to speak a translation. So it's a bit like simultaneous interpretation. And the idea is that we create a pair of sound files. One is the original and one is the translation, and we archive them together. And the result is something like a modern version of the Rosetta Stone with multiple languages, and that, you know, in some remote future when a linguist finds this in an archive, they should be able to decipher the language, even if no linguist today actually did any work on the grammar.
Stephen, a couple of weeks ago we did a program on the transformational effects of the mobile phone, particularly in India, where, as you know, there are, you know, simply hundreds and hundreds of millions of them, and they're remaking, or they're attacking much more effectively than pious legislation, the whole structure of a society which treats its Dalit so badly. And here's another use of the simple tool that to save cultures.
Yes, so people will often assume that culture is opposed, or technology is opposed to culture. And so when I go into a remote Indigenous community and show them some technology and then do something which is affirming of their traditional culture, the most surprising thing is that the elders, you know, the least technological people, often those who are monolingual in the ancestral language, they're the ones who get most excited. They tear up, they tell stories, start really proselytizing the language to the younger generation.
Going back to the Indian example, here's a technology that leapfrogs literacy. It enables people to interconnect and to, you know, organize politically, who can't put two words together on paper. And you're dealing with people who, of course, don't need to be literate.
Exactly. This is the main benefit of this approach. So linguists are continuing to write down languages, but for a language which hasn't been actually written down in a normal writing system, the only way to do this is using something called the International Phonetic Alphabet. And if you're not a linguist, you can't do that. And so we want to have a way to preserve these languages where you do not need to write anything down. So instead, we just get people to listen and speak into another language. And that's actually a very effective way to ensure that in a future era, somebody will be able to transcribe and translate those, ancestral stories and oral literature.
This is LNL on RN, where we're discussing new and dying languages with the guests Stephen Bird and Carmel O'Shaughnessy. I feel that I'm building a little bridge between you and Steve, Carmel. Is there any applicability to what he's doing, to what you're
doing?
Yes, about?
Absolutely. I think that software would be very well received here. I also think that technology here is very, very popular, and I think it is a kind of a bridge to literacy. Because whereas before people didn't spend too much time with mail that came in on paper, for example, now a group of people will crowd around the computer to do internet banking or text on their phone. I mean, right here, I'm sitting here with four people, and they're on three phones at the moment, and I'm on a fourth, and they're all texting. So I think technology has a really fast take-up.
Before we wind this up, Carmel, I want you to tell us about The Village, which I understand was created in 1948 by the Australian government to forcibly relocate people.
Right. So the original motivation was also to provide a reserve area for people, many of whom were working on cattle stations in the area at the time. And the idea was that there needed to be a place for people who weren't living and working on the cattle station to come and live. But what in fact happened then was that people were forcibly brought up from the southern Walpole area by truck and simply told, you know, here you are, live here now. And that was a huge adjustment for people to have to make. And I think they've been incredibly resilient in the way that they've been able to make a new life here, which was certainly not of their choosing.
Stephen, we've got a feeling for this village in Australia. Tell me about one of the villages that you've been dealing with in the Amazon.
Well, the village of Kajueru, which I was starting to describe, it's made up of about 20 or so wooden huts with wooden tile roofs and earth floors. And if you go inside someone's house, you'll probably see a kid or an adult sitting in front of a television, but sitting in a hammock. Nearby, there'll be a river, and that'll often be the only way in and out. And they'll be surrounded by the biggest rainforest on the planet, and that'll be their source of food. And the key thing, though, is that you're alone and you are dealing with incredible isolation. And, you know, the biggest challenge is trying to figure out what just happened when you thought you were going to be meeting somebody and they didn't show up. You went and found them and they just decided at that moment they needed to go off fishing.
Mm. Stephen, does the death of language in these parts of the Amazon, does that also mean the death of religion? Does it mean the death of the culture?
That's probably the most confronting part about visiting one of these villages. You realize that you are living inside a fading culture with a marginalized people and a dying language, and it's all fading away.
God, it's something to think about, isn't it? Carmel, there might be other new languages that are bubbling up here and there that no one knows about because you're not studying them.
there probably are. It's a great opportunity and a privilege to be able to document this language as it stabilizes and develops over time. There is another new language that's similar to this one in a community nearby, about 100 kilometers away, Gurindji Creole. It's not exactly the same as this language. It's not exactly the same kind of combination, but it's somewhat similar. And this kind of combination is quite rare, so we're very fortunate linguistically to have this opportunity to observe them.
A final question to you, Stephen. On languages, are the languages in PNG, in fact across New Guinea, are they dying as fast?
We actually don't know. So there needs to be a survey so that we can really study this. One of the languages I work in, called Usarufa, has 1,000 speakers, but nobody under the age of 25 speaks. So, you know, in another 40 years, it will simply be gone. However, there are even smaller languages, languages with 50 speakers, where children are learning, and so they have a viable population and good intergenerational transfer. So we can be optimistic that at least for the current generation, it will continue. But really, we don't know. In Papua New Guinea, there's 830 or so living languages, and, you know, likelihood is that most of them will be gone in 100 years.
I thank you both very, very much. Stephen Bird, Associate Professor in Computer Science at the University of Melbourne, and Dr. Carmel O'Shaughnessy, a linguist at the University of Michigan. And that's the program for today. For more information about any of the programs, you can visit our website on abc.net.au/radionational. Look in programs for Late Night Live. You can follow us on Twitter at LNL on RN or me at philipadams_1. That's our lot for now. Stick around on RN, and I will see you later.